Okay, or
did you say anything about the recycling?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. There are several of you who missed the comments on the paper. Who missed the comments on the paper? So why don't we huddle in the corridor after class, please, because there's another class that'll come in, and I don't want to repeat the whole thing in front of class. So we can have a consultation after class, okay? All right. Couple announcements, but maybe you want to start first, and then I'll go into some things, and then we'll go into Molly's presentation.
Okay. Okay. For those of you who haven't noticed, we're recording today. My name is Janine Ovens, and I'm here on behalf of the University of Michigan's English Language Institute. We're recording this class today as part of a research project started in winter of 98 to collect about 175 hours of spoken English from a wide range of academic settings. The purpose of collecting this data, formally called a corpus, is to provide a source of authentic speech for use in English language teaching and testing materials and linguistic research. Your instructor has given us permission to do the recording today with the understanding that no identifying information, like last names, for instance, will be used in the transcript. Your participation in today's class implies your consent to the recording and to the use of the data for teaching and research purposes, unless you let us know afterwards that there are parts of your speech that you'd rather not have included in the transcript. One of the ways the transcript will be used is as part of an online web-accessible database available to linguists for research purposes. The website is hosted by the university's Humanities Text Initiative, so it's, you know, legal and all that. So does anybody have any questions about the project or?
How much are we getting paid?
You question am I getting paid? I don't know yet, but I think nothing. I have no expectations, so let's put it that way.
Any other questions?
So what are you going to do with this?
What we do is we collect the spoken data and then we transcribe everything, and it gets put on this website so that it's searchable. We're not looking for individual teaching styles. We're not looking for content. It's basically available so that other linguists can go to the website and do searches called concordances. Basically what that is a word search, and it'll give you the context on either side so that people can look at syntactic patterns or do lexical studies on how particular words or phrases are being used. So, any other questions? Okay.
So we'll just forget it's there. Now, one announcement. Janelle, I won't use her last name, recorded for us an A&E program which ran Sunday night, right? And I missed it because I never have time to watch TV. But she recorded it. It's a video recording, and it's excellent. It's actually called The Good Book of Love, Sex in the Bible. It's really fine. It's quite excellent. It's well done. There's a lot of artwork in it as background. The narration is good. They have 11 esteemed biblical scholars giving different perspectives on the various topics on sex in the Bible. I have put it in the Language Resource Center. The Language Resource Center is on the second floor of the Modern Languages building. You can look at it. I think up to five of you can look at any one time, so there's more than one of you who shows up. These are the hours. They're quite liberal. I thought about how do I get this how is this best accessible to you? And I figured if I put it into the Language Resource Center, it would be very fine. So it'll be there till the end of the term. It'll give you ideas. The discussion is excellent also in terms of attitudes towards sexuality in the Old Testament as opposed to the New Testament, as opposed to the early Christian writers, St. Augustine, and so on. So look at it, get some ideas. It might help you with your paper, who knows. And thank Janelle.
Thank you, Janelle.
Any questions on that? It takes, an hour and 45 minutes if you look at the whole thing. So it's time well spent. any questions or comments? Some of you missed last time. Some of you were busy dancing. What was the dancing for, Kyle?
It was a fundraiser for the Children's Hospital and Beaumont Hospital.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Which Children's Hospital?
Beaumont?
And Mott's.
Mott's. Okay. Did you raise lots of money?
Yeah, we did.
And you danced nonstop? More or less?
Yeah, more or less.
Wow. Okay. So now you're rested. Maybe you can get notes from someone. Any questions or comments regarding last time's session? One more point I wanted to make about the Daughters of Zelophehad. And I alluded to it, maybe I didn't stress it enough. We have here a legal case. Jill, you'll want to know. Look back on it. And if any of you want to meet with me sometime, talk about some of this, it's fine. What is so interesting about that story, these five daughters, is not only that they present the case, which we already talked about, they present the legal case to the heads of the state. I mean, this is a little bit intimidating, but they presented themselves with all the legal arguments. They presented themselves. They don't get themselves a spokesman. They don't get themselves some man to speak for them because they're only women, okay? Not only do they present the case legally in the correct legal language and legal arguments and all of that, but they present it themselves. You're talking about a patriarchal society, but they're not intimidated by that. They hold their own. They present their case well. They're mentioned in Joshua. That's rehearsed in Numbers. So they really make a point for themselves. Now, how many of us present our own legal case in court? Not many. And so if we're intimidated by this in our modern age, I think it speaks very well for women being heard, being acknowledged, being given recognition. They won their own legal case. It's taken to the deity. Moses takes it to God, which is only proper in his role as prophet. He is the mouthpiece of God. God gives the judgment, but they give them a serious hearing. And so that's one of the points. I don't know if I honed in on it enough because we sort of ran out of time, but it's very interesting in terms of setting precedent, in terms of setting jurisprudence and so on. Have any of you had experience with the law, with legal things? How did that go?
Good.
Good. I've had experience with the law, too. I built this little old cottage up north after I got the foundation. I had all the permits. I got the foundation in. I got a stop order. All the constructions on the harbor, it's on Presqu'ile Harbor, got stop orders one November. 9 constructions, and mine among them. They all went with a legal case, with a legal firm. I said, no way am I going with a legal firm. I'm not building this house on spec. It's mine. The logs are on site. I've already paid for the roof. I'll do the legal work myself. And I did, and it took me months. But I got the permit. I had to fight the DNR, the Fish, Game, and Wildlife Commission, the Army Corps, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. They know me. And the people in the area. Anyways, you can take a case and you can win. So there you are, the Daughters of Zelophehad, and I think I've said enough, but I did want to bring that out. Any other questions or comments on that? Then we should let Molly have time and take as much time as you like, and then we'll go into Deborah. And if we don't finish Deborah today, we'll finish Deborah next time.
Okay, I'm going to do a presentation on the Song of Songs. And I just became interested in it after Erica's talk when Professor Beck said something about there's the only other instance of, like, at, like, besides Rebecca at the well of the kiss was, like, Song of Songs. And then I remembered my cousin's a folk singer, and she wrote a song based on the Song of Songs, which I'll play for you later. It's really short, but I brought that in. But I have a different Bible version than you, so you'll just have to find it yourself. But it's very short, and I really, really liked it a lot. And it's one of my favorite books in the Bible, just because I think it's just really beautiful language. But as far as interpretations, I found so much information. I'm going to try to put as much in as I can, and there's still some things that I want to put in that I just don't have time for. But there's two main interpretations. One is the rabbinical interpretation from the Midrash, which is scripture interpretation, Jewish scripture interpretation, and that's from the rabbis. And they say that it's not a love story. It's not a love song. It's not nuptial vows. It is a metaphor between God and the Jewish people, just signifying the love and the marriage between God and the Jewish people and the covenant. And the rabbis who wrote the Midrash aren't exactly feminists, first of all. And second of all, the only way they could probably get the Song of Songs, or it's also called the Song of Solomon, into the Bible would be to make a metaphor out of it, because it does have sexual, erotic undertones, things that aren't supposed to be appropriate for the Bible, you know, at that time or whatever. The structure of it is kind of confusing sometimes, because in some parts of these eight short chapters, it's very clear that there's a female voice. In some, it's very clear that there's a male voice, and in some areas, it's kind of ambiguous. So Jewish feminists take that opportunity to infer God's feminine or nurturing aspects. And so that's where, like, the whole Jewish feminist Jewish standpoint started in this. As far as the question of authorship, what the rabbis say, it's attributed to Solomon. And then the first line is the Song of Songs, which is to Solomon, which could mean that A, he wrote it, B, it belongs to him, or C, the subject matter is directed towards him. And Solomon's name is mentioned 6 times in the book. But another interpretation is that several people wrote different parts, different poems in it, and then later on they were all assembled together. The Christian approach, and I didn't find very much on the Christian views of the Song of Songs, but it's supposed to be the romance of Jesus and the church with Mary as the chief female figure. So that's the Christian approach. Am I going too fast? Okay. Characters. There's two main interpretation is there's two main characters, and one interpretation is there's three. And I don't really see three, but the two main characters are Solomon and a Shulamite shepherdess, and it's the female lover is the Rhea, I think. I don't know how to pronounce it, but it's R-H-Y, and that's the female. And then the male is the Dodi. So those are, like, that interpretation with the two main characters. The one with the three main characters, and I didn't see this at all, but I read it. It's Solomon and another shepherd, and they're, like, vying for the affection of the Shulamite woman. So that is the rabbinic approach. The feminist approach is, I just think, is so awesome. And I found an entire book about the feminist approaches to the Song of Songs, and there's so much good stuff in it. What it is it, like, the feminists say it's completely secular. It's one of the most only secular parts that is unbiased. And they say that there is kind of like one opaque mention of God, and that's in chapter 8, verse 6. And it says, set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm, for love is strong as death, passion fierce as the grave, it flashes, its flashes are flashes of fire, a raging flame. And the reason I could see that, but I would have had to have been directed to see it, is because in Jewish tradition you have what's called tefillin, and it's a box with a prayer inside attached to some leather straps, and you wind it around your head and around your arms in a certain way that's supposed to symbolize the shape of God. You wind it around your hand in the shape of the Jewish letter shin, which means God. And so that's why I thought it was a seal upon your arm. And then, because God has appeared in fire before. So that's the only thing I see. But otherwise, it's fairly secular. It can be, the Song of Songs is read as less biased from the rest of the Bible because the enormous significance of the female element. The feminist interpretation says that they, at the very least, some of the poetry of the Song of Songs should be attributed to feminist perspectives or even feminist authorship. And because of this, the text provides a way to discuss culture and reclamation, the affinities of the Song of Songs with other poems in the, or other female poems in the Bible, the Song of Deborah, the Song of Miriam.
There's a question.
Oh.
Okay, I haven't read the Song of Songs, so could you just give like a general...
Sure.
Like, because I've never read it, so I don't know what it's about or anything.
It is a dialogue, and it's been called a drama between the bride and the bridegroom. It's, a lot of people think it's nuptials, or just people professing their love. It's very flowery, kind of beautiful, poetic language, really different from the prose that's the rest of the Bible, or the, you know, stuff that isn't a song, per se. And there's a lot of metaphor in it, and like I said, the metaphor, like the rabbinic scholars see it not at all as a conversation between a man and a woman, but as God and the people.
Is that why they think it's in there?
Yeah, that's why.
How they justify its inclusion. It's a metaphor for God as the bridegroom and Israel as the bride. So it's a celebration of the bridegroom. So you can read it on a number of levels. And one of them, and that's why it's in the canon, it's canonized, it's part of the sanctified text, is that it's seen on that level as a metaphor between God the bridegroom and Israel the bride, because in Amos, for example, Hosea, God is the husband and Israel is the wife. That's one level. But that's a little hard to see. But that's how some people interpret it. But what Molly's saying, and I would concur, it's a celebration of sexuality primarily seen from the woman's voice. I mean, if you really want to celebrate sex, there it is. Read it. It's interesting. And read a modern, more modern translation than this one, or read several. Go to Borders. Go to Chain Drums. Sit there. You don't have to buy the book.
There's a book called Discovering Eve, and I can't remember the author right now. I didn't read it, but it was. Somebody suggested it to me. That as far as social attitudes go, it seems like it has completely different social attitude from like the patriarchal other parts of the Bible. It shows a loving couple, equal relationship, and which is singular in the Old Testament because it doesn't show often equality of the husband and the wife, the man and the woman. And the female voice and the female figure is much more prominent. There's allusions to matrilineal and matrilocal values, and what that means anthropologically is matrilineal is where you trace your family line through your mother, and matrilocal means that you live where your mother lives. It isn't, however, matriarchal, which is it's because the entire Bible is written in a patriarchal sense. And this kind of ties into modern Jewish thought, even previous Jewish thought, is that the religion of your child depends on the religion of the mother. Like, for instance, my father's very Irish Catholic, except my mother's Jewish, so I was raised Jewish. So that's how it's, that's like a matrilineal line.
Just like Moses' mother.
There are fratrilineal and fratriarchal aspects, which means the power belongs to the women's brothers, and I'll get into that a little bit later. But there are no, or very few or no apparent references to a patriarchal society. And I think this is really cool because it's just, it's like a stepping stone for constructions of social order. Even if, you know, after you get through the Song of Songs and then you just go back to regular, it just kind of was like a ray of light or a ray of hope for women. That's the way I read it. The words of the Riyah, the woman lover, comprise most of the book. And the most important element is of her wishful thinking, of her dreams, of her hopes, and her love, and it all determines the plot and the framework of the whole book, and it's all hers. So I just thought that was really cool. If you take it, and it doesn't take very long, if you go through it pretty thoroughly, you can just see how much more she is involved in it than the male role. Which is not to say anything bad about the male role. It's just that she has the majority of the emotion and of the text and stuff in here. There's three detailed descriptions of her, of the female lover in the book, and only one of the male. And a lot of like Egyptian poetry. I read a lot about Egyptian poetry because Egyptian and Arabic, Islamic, because it's all kind of a little bit related. And Egyptian poetry only depicts the female body, never the male. But they don't really, it seemed when I was reading it that they don't really do it in kind of a gawky way, just to show the beauty. And the Song of Songs is considered a wedding song by a lot of people. And very often there's bits of the Song of Songs in nuptial vows and in Jewish weddings. Only the beauty of the bride are sung. It's all about, the bride and her beauty and her day. And this is, I'll tell you the song now. My cousin Julie lives in California, and she's a folk singer. And she has a sister named Robin, my other cousin, and she wrote it for her sister and sang it at her wedding and then later put it on this album. So I think it's really pretty. It's called, the title of the song is You Have Captured My Heart. And if you read the Song of Songs, then you should be able to recognize some lines taken directly from the text.
I will take you to the garden. I will take you with me. You have captured my heart, my own. You have captured my heart, shining through like the new dawn. Like a lily among the thorns, how sweet is your love. You have captured my heart, my own. You have captured my heart. How sweet. how sweet is your
lines like in chapter 2 verse 2 it says is a lily among the brambles, like, and my and the song says like a lily among the thorns, said my beloved is mine and I am his. That's 2:16. How sweet is your love, my sister, my bride. That's 4:10. So I mean, she just kind of took various lines and put them in where they fit. The way of life is feminine. It never talks about any fathers or any male-dominated society. The bride refers to my mother's house several times, which infers that her father's dead. So that's where the fratricidal lineage comes in, because once her fathers die, her brothers take over. King when it talks about Solomon, it only talks about his mother. And in 3:11, it says, look, O daughters of Zion, at King Solomon, at the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, on the day of the gladness in his heart. So it appears that his mother has an important role in his wedding as well. King Solomon, I'll just give you some numbers about the different sexes that are mentioned various times. King Solomon talks about his friends, his companions, and says twice in passing, and it's just in the third person. While the bride's own friends, and she calls them daughters of Jerusalem, daughters of Zion, are mentioned 7 times. It mentions daughters or young women 5 times, and I, in reference to the female lover, more than a dozen times. Does anybody have any questions so far?
Mm-hmm. In chapter 1, it has the first person plural. Verse 4, we rejoice and delight in you, and we will praise your love more than wine. I was just wondering what you thought that was.
I think that she's talking, I think it's the bride and her friends are talking. I think it's her friends actually talking to her.
The interpretation of this that I'm familiar with is that there's the bride and the groom, and then there's this group of friends who are kind of narrators. And they kind of pitch in from time to time. as...
Yeah, other as, women, and that's the refrain, the chorus. That's one of the interpretations.
Okay. I thought this was really neat. And this, I think that this is, I want to say Phyllis Tribble in this collection of women feminists who wrote this really great book. And I'll put the source on the board afterwards. In Genesis, in the Adam and Eve story, when God punishes or curses Eve and says, you shall desire your husband and he will be your master. And the woman's inclination and the woman's desire subjugate her to Adam, Eve to Adam. But in the Song of Songs, chapter 7, verse 10, it says, I am my lover's, his desire is for me. So here, I think she unties this bondage from Genesis, and then we encounter a new relationship between the two sexes. And it's equality and mutuality. So I really liked that part a lot. There were in the wake of the goddesses, there were very many things, but it's said, Tikva Frymer-Kensky says that the Bible treats sex as just kind of like it's a commodity, or it's just something for procreation, and it's all about with whom and where and when. And in the Song of Songs, sex is unconstrained, or sexuality or eroticism is unconstrained by social considerations. And it recognizes that sex comes from love and not just procreation or, marriage in terms of creating alliances. So love comes from love. And she's never called a wife. She's never asked to procreate. Never asked a child bear. So that one that is in the wake of the goddesses. The last thing that I wanted to say was that in the medieval times in Portugal, women used to come together and sing to each other about women, just like in a celebration. And there's a really remarkable degree of similarity between the Song of Songs, and then it's called the Cantigas de Amigo. And in it, they do this same kind of things where they talk about eroticism and sexuality, and they're all talking to other women, but they don't express it literally. They make it for interpretation. And they call each other beautiful, which I really like. And in chapter 1, verse 5, it says, I'm black and beautiful. And so it's just... I read the reason it says I'm black and beautiful, it's because she's not royalty. She's a commoner, and she's been working in the vineyards or working in the pastures, so her skin is all tanned. And, just her own, that she thinks she's beautiful, that I really like that part. And that's basically all I have. I really like it because there's a lot of strong women in the Bible, but it doesn't give a lot of description of them, and it doesn't give them a lot of depth. You can just kind of see by their actions that they're strong, but women as lovers with emotional depth aren't really shown except for in here, and most of them are given the short shrift, and I really like that this was mainly a women's thing in here. Does anybody have any questions? I was just going to ask if what you guys thought about the interpretation, how you feel about the meaning of the metaphor with the rabbinic metaphor or a feminist metaphor, or if there's like a mix of both.
I think it probably could be a mix of both. Like, I think both interpretations are valuable. I think, like, the feminist interpretation is really valuable on a personal level. I think, and especially to women in sexuality, and even to men in sexuality. And I think that the rabbinic thing is also really a good interpretation for religious purposes and for, like, faith purposes. And it could be a really beautiful poem to express, like, a relationship with God and people, too. I think that both interpretations are good ones.
I also heard an interpretation that the Song of Songs was, like, about God's gift of, like, love and sexuality and marriage to people, like a gift for us, and that it was written in there, like, because nowhere else does it say it. I don't know, because all the mainly poetic books are pretty much lumped together, and, like, a lot of them are about, like, all kinds of random things, but this one's, like, all about, like, love and marriage and this whole theme, and I don't know, one interpretation was just that it was in there to show that it was a gift for us or something. I don't have references for that, though.
No, I it sounds familiar, and I think that that's really cool.
It's interesting that you talked about, you know, the Bible's view of sex, and I don't think the entire Bible is anti-sex. I mean,
I don't
you
think
can, your statement was a little, I think, overgeneral, I thought. I mean, you can't find other references, especially in the New Testament, I think, that indicate that it's a gift.
I don't think it's looked down upon, but I think in terms of, I really don't like when they say, it's archaic language, obviously, but when they say he knew her, he lay with her, it just seems like a chore or something, you know? And the Midrash isn't, obviously, for the New Testament, so, and that's what I did research on, the rabbinic research of it. But, I don't think that the Bible is wholly against anti-sexuality, but I do think that it's very cautious, maybe even overly cautious, in a modern sense. Anybody else?
I think it's a wonderful statement of sexuality. The way it starts, the Song of Songs, that's already hyperbole. That's the highest song. And it's a poem, and it's a song. It's the highest song. That's what it means, Song of Songs. And then it starts into a celebration of love. The imagery is of fruit, of figs, of wine, of pomegranates, of mandrakes. It's all a celebration of love and sexuality. In a very positive way, and upholds that, and I think you're absolutely right, and it's uninhibited, and that's the beauty of it, a celebration of uninhibited eroticism, and that's what makes it so unusual in the Bible, and they did include it in the canon, and that's interesting too. But you start out with sexual imagery. Oh, that you would kiss me with the kisses of your mouth, for your love is better than wine. Your anointing oils are fragrant. Your name is oil poured out. It's already a celebration. And then, as you said, in the next verse, even before that, we will extol and rejoice, and you will extol your love more than wine. Rightly do they love you. And then the next verse, I am dark and beautiful. That's the translation. It's not here, but that, you know, scholars have argued that is the correct way to interpret it. It's not but, it's and. And so all of what she's done, she's been out in the field, she's been in the vineyard, she's been in the sun, she's beautiful. And the whole thing is a celebration, and it's overt eroticism. Upon my bed at night, I sought him. I mean, it keeps going. It's wonderful poetry, and it's a real celebration. And it takes you right back to the Garden of Eden was all of the springtime ritual, the blossoms in spring. God brings Eve to Adam so that they will be one flesh. That's the celebration of marriage. And you have it all over here, the same kind of imagery as you have in the Garden of Eden. And I think that intensifies that. If that adds anything, I don't know. Yes?
I was going to say, too, that, I mean, even if it is looked at as, even if it's taken as an interpretation of God's relationship with Israel, the fact that they use such sexual images and ideas says something for the sexual experience. I mean, the fact that they're using that in that interpretation to represent a relationship between God and humans really says a lot for how amazing and wonderful human sexual experiences are. They can use it that way, so.
And the description of the anatomy, it's all there. None of it's couched. I mean, they talk about all of the, you know, all of the female body, the breasts, everything, on down. In a language of celebration, it's really quite remarkable. So, yeah.
Here's another thing that I didn't mention, but it's kind of interesting, is it's just, this is just something I got off the web, and it's an interpretation that it's all about unity, and that especially in the kiss, it says in here that the kiss of love extends into four spirits, and the spirits are supernal chariot, companionship, unison, and wholeness. And the four spirits are the four limbs of the body. And when two people kiss, or two people join, maybe in intercourse or something, that each of the four spirits, or each of the four limbs of the body, they flow into one another, and they all unite. And I think it really makes a statement about unity and equality, because everything that we've read so far is just the difference between the women, and there just seems to be, at least for me, there just seems to be such a huge gap between the men and the women, and they're always separated by just something that's not equal, and that it's let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. It's the second verse. That's what this says here. And then there's some Hebrew letters that denote the spirit, the four spirits, whatever. So I liked that whole unity idea.
If you look at chapter 2, verse 16, 17, my beloved is mine and I am his. That's sexual union. He pastures his flock among the lilies. Lilies has been used as a metaphor for women's genitalia. So what are they talking about? It's quite clear. Until the day breeze and the shadows flee. So it's all about a night of lovemaking. Turn, my beloved, be like a gazelle or a young stag upon a rugged mountain or upon rugged mountains. Those are the breasts. I mean, it's really, it's the imagery is beautiful, but, and it's lofty, but it's very graphic. It's right there.
I think that if people were trying to get this in, regardless of what they thought, what the authors wrote it as, I think that they were very smart in getting it in there for whomever's, for whatever point of view you take it for, it's in there. I mean, that's the point, that it's in there, and I think however you interpret it, or whatever you take from it, from, you know, however many interpretations there are, it's important.
Did you say that this, like, from your research, like, it was credited to Solomon? Because, like, when he wrote a lot of this stuff, it was after, like, he had turned away from God and come back, and it seems like, I don't know, I just had this funny thought that, like if he had that kind of experience, like, if it was a man writing this, it would be more likely to be about, like, the actual, like, less than metaphorical sense. You know, like, he was using all these metaphors to describe like sexual relations, but it's probably less likely that it was like him thinking about this is God's union with Israel. You know what I mean?
It's not attributed to Solomon. It's linked to Solomon somehow, because Solomon had, he built the temple, he had wisdom. Somehow it comes at that point in Israel where they are at the height, their golden age. And so the song is linked to him in that way. But they don't attribute authorship. Well, they argue about it, but I don't think
that okay. In the Anchor Bible Dictionary, it says it has no, like, no one has, like, said that there's one, you know, one attributed author. There's continuous arguments about it.
Could have been someone in his court, though, that he hired, or
it
that's
comes,
why it could
yeah,
be.
From a high period of literacy in the history of Israel. Thank you, Molly. That was very nice. Any other questions or comments before we go on to the account of Deborah and JL? Okay. It's just very interesting, and I left a book there for you in case you want to take a look. I finally dug it out of my library. Okay. Let's go on to the story of Deborah, Judges 4 and 5. It's a marvelous story. We may not finish it, that's all right. It's a very, very interesting story, and yet not much space is given to it. You could blink and you'd miss it. But it's a celebration of woman in a number of aspects. She is, we have some other sources. In Josephus, she was called, or she had the task of keeping the tabernacle lamps in the priestly tradition. So that's a sort of a lowly task, but nonetheless important to the temple tradition, highly regarded. She's a prophetess, and the prophetess is the mouthpiece of the deity of God. She's called a judge in the account. She's also a visionary. She has a sense of the future. She has a sense of mission. You might say she's parallel to perhaps their version of Joan of Arc. She's a military leader. She wins victories. How do we get to all that? She is introduced into the text in chapter 4. Israel is in a time of trial. They have been under the king Jabin for 20 years. He's been king of Canaan. He's oppressed Israel. That's some of the other accounts. The vineyards have been destroyed. The women have been dishonored. We know what that means. The children have been slain. Many have turned to worship idols. So it's a low point in the history of Israel. But we're in Judges, and Judges is sort of, in a sense, a heroic time. And so then we get into the story of Deborah. Judges 4, the verse 3, where there's Sisera, his army. How many chariots does he have? 900 chariots. That's a lot of chariots, right? How many armed warriors go with this? So that's a huge army. And chariots are formidable weapons. And don't underrate them. We're in the Iron Age. Israel hasn't got chariots. What pulls chariots?
Horses.
Well, they barely started having horses. They got them, well, it's still early. But nonetheless, Israel doesn't have chariots. They don't have iron, much of an iron culture. They don't have horses. They don't have the equipment. They don't have the arms. They don't have the iron. And here is Sisera, lording it over them, and he oppressed the people cruelly for 20 years, the end of verse 3. And then we're introduced to this woman, Deborah, a prophetess. She's a wife. She's not stressed for her wifely role, but she's a wife. And what does she do? She's judging Israel at that time. Where does she judge? What's her seat? Where's her seat? Where does she do this judging? She sits under a tree. What kind of a tree? A palm tree called Deborah. She has her own palm tree. This is her ground. This is the palm tree called Deborah. The palms were stately. And she's in the hill country here between Beit El and Ramah. In the hill country, you could look at it on the map. We'll look at it on the map in a minute. And it's repeated, the people of Israel came to her for judgment. Now, the people of Israel are under oppression. What kind of cases is she hearing and judging? And she's judging them. She has this plateau. She's got this great palm tree she sits under. She's up from Jericho in the hill country. You can imagine, it doesn't tell us, but she's listening to their cases and she's judging, and they're coming to her from everywhere. She's well known. She's highly regarded. So what does she do then? She sends for and summons Barak from the son of Abinoam from Kadesh in Naphtali. So she sends for the foremost military leader, and he comes. Now that's rather remarkable. Look at your map. In the back you have your maps, right? Remember your maps? Map 3. Israel and Canaan, Joshua to Samuel and Saul. And you look at up from Jerusalem. You see Beit El. She's between Ramah and Beit El. Do you see it there? Up in the hill country. And then she sends for Barak, and he's in Kadesh. Now look at where Kadesh is. You go past the Lake of Kinneret, which is the Lake of Galilee. You keep going up the Jordan River, and you see Kadesh there. Do you see it? That's a long way away. He's not just in the neighboring town. And later on, the battle will take place at the River of Kishon near the Mount Carmel. Do you see it there? Harosheth Hagoyim, near the Mediterranean. So that's where you're going to have the battle lines drawn. But she sends for him way up north and he comes down. So all of this is kind of an understatement. And she summons him and she says to him, "The Lord God of Israel commands you." That's her role as prophetess. She speaks through God. She speaks through the deity. And then she orders him, "Gather your men at Mount Tabor, taking 10,000 from the tribe of Naphtali and from the tribe of Zebulun, and I will draw out Sisera, the general of Jabin's army, to meet you by the river Kishon with his chariots and his troops, and I will give him into your hand." So she's calling him out. She's commanding him. She's got a battle plan. She's got all kinds of confidence. She conveys it to him. And a lot of it is behind the scenes. She trusts God. First, she's the counselor of the people, the judge in their disputes. Then she becomes the deliverer of the people. She makes a plan. They've been oppressed for 20 years. Nobody else has come along. So she trusted God implicitly. She could inspire in others the same trust. She inspires it in Barak, sort of, not right away. Barak says to her, and these are the most unusual lines in biblical history. He says, this mighty general, if you will go with me, I will go. If you will not go, I won't go. Okay? And she responds, I will surely go with you. She doesn't say, oh, wait, let me ask my husband, right? She makes her own decisions. She says, yes, I will surely go. And then she prophesies some more. So she's, in a sense, the personification of this free spirit in Israel. She understands what she's doing. She's got all kinds of self-confidence. She says, the road on which you are going will not lead to your glory, for God will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman. Now you're going to think she means herself, but she doesn't. Okay? But she does. It's like a riddle. We've run into riddles before, right? It's like an oracle. So Sisera, you're not going to get the glory for this. A woman is going to get the glory. And then she arose and went with Barak to Kadesh, and then Barak summons the army, these 10,000. So he's doing it on her word, on her confidence, on her inspiration, on her vision. So in a sense, she becomes the chieftain. From the role of homemaker, keeper of tabernacle lights, she now is in the hill country and is becoming military leader, co-leader. So together, they work out a plan of action. Together, they plan and plot. He gathers the men, and it repeats again, last part of verse 10, Deborah went up with him. Then we get to this next little, the next verse, Heber. That's really anticipating what comes next. Heber, who's he? He's a Canaanite. Heber the Kenite. They're descendants of Hobab. He's the father-in-law of Moses. And he's pitched his tent as far away as the oak in Zaananim, which is near Kadesh. So, but who is Heber? Anybody know? Remember?
He's Jael's husband.
He's Jael's husband. So here we're introduced to Jael's husband. And the reason for this introduction here is that Sisera thinks that the Kenite is going to be loyal to him. And so that's they had separated themselves, and they were sort of off in their own tents. So they are itinerant, they're wanderers, and they're living in tents. Then we get back to the main action. So Sisera gathers his chariots, his 900 chariots of iron. It repeats it for emphasis, and all the men who were with him. And they get to the river Kishon. And then there's Deborah. And you can sort of see her standing on a rock. She is the one who tells him what to do. She is the one who inspires him to action. She says, what does she say? Up, 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 get up. She tells him, this is the day in which the Lord has given Sisera into your hand. Does not the Lord go out before you? So she's telling him, she's dictating the action, she's commanding the beginning of the battle. She says, up, Barak. And so Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him, so he's got his 10,000, it's repeated. Now, from other sources, from Josephus. Do you remember Josephus? Okay, he's the historian I mentioned before. From Josephus we know, and also from the Song of Deborah, which comes later, we get some pieces of information on how the battle went. the text here doesn't tell us. But Josephus says that a storm of sleet and hail burst out over the plain from the east, driving into the face of Sisera and his men and his charioteers. And the slingers and the archers, do you remember the movie Ben-Hur? How do they fight with chariots? How does it work?
They run into each other?
Yeah, in Ben-Hur they do. They have this race.
Don't they sort of, they'll run up and fire their arrows, you know, sort of, and then turn around and run back? Or
so it's not the best way of fighting. The Greeks then, under Alexander the Great, developed the stirrups. Well, actually, they were developed a little sooner, but then you had a horseman on a horse with stirrups, and then he could fire the arms without having another man guide the horses. See, in a chariot, you've got someone guiding the chariots and then these other guys in the chariot firing away, but it's a very cumbersome way of fighting. So anyways, the storm came, the sleet and hail in their faces, handicapping the men and the chariots, and the slingers and archers were disabled by the beating rain, and the swordsmen were crippled by the biting cold. I'm sure they weren't wearing stuff. I mean, or else what were they wearing? Cloaks, and that hampers your arms. Deborah and Barak had the storm behind them, and they saw that the storm was lashing the enemy, and they pushed on. And of course, this is Yahweh, the storm god. This is divine providence. This is the deity looking after them, I'm sure giving them courage, as Deborah had prophesied. And then with all this rain and sleet, the flood waters went down the Kishon River, and what happened to the chariots? They sank in the mud. Whereas these foot soldiers, who didn't have much of anything except their hand arms, slew the enemy. They were not hampered by weight. They were not hampered by iron. They weren't hampered by shields and arms that are heavy. So then you go on with the story. The Lord routed Sisera. That's really what this is all about. And Josephus, augments the story. In all his chariot and all his army before Barak at the edge of the sword, and Sisera alighted from his chariot. So Sisera then, what does he do, this heroic guy? He leaves his soldiers in the lurch and runs off. That's not what the leader of the army is supposed to do, right? He runs away. He fled away on foot, and Barak pursued the chariots and the army to Harosheth by Goyim, and all the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword. Not a man was left. That's a complete rout. And of course, the Israelites may have had geographic advantage and so on, we don't know. So here's the only guy that was left, and he fled away on foot, Sisera, to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber. There you are. And there was peace between Jabin, the king of Hazor, and the house of Heber. So Sisera thinks he's safe. And Jael comes out and invites him into the tent. Very interesting. And she says to him, "Turn aside, my lord, have no fear." She doesn't say, "I'm not going to do anything to you." She says, "Have no fear." You might say that's a little misleading. And so he went into her tent, and she covered him with a rug. See, why is she covering him with a rug?
Relax him, to get him comfortable, warm, and sleepy.
Yeah, he's cold. He's been out in the sleet, in the ice. He's soaked to the skin. She's covering him with a rug. He needs to get warm, and he said to her, "Give me a little water." So he asks for water to drink. What does she give him to... Pardon? Milk. Why? Yeah. See, when you've raised children, when you've raised kids, you know. You give them something to eat, what do they do next?
They
fall asleep. I used to take Michael up north, my grandson. It's always a long trip. What do I do? About an hour into the trip, I feed him and he eats, and next thing you know, he's sound asleep in the seat next to me. The word stillen in German, ein Kind stillen, ein Baby stillen, means to nurse a baby and to quiet a baby. So that's where you get the English be still, right? So you give a baby milk, every mother knows it, and then you put the baby to sleep. So here he is, Sisera in the tent, and she's giving him the milk, the curds and whatever, and he's nice and satisfied, and then he says, okay, watch out. She's been having this in mind all along. She takes the tent peg, right? Now, what does that tell you about her?
She's strong.
She's determined. She gets only one chance, right? If she blows it, she's had it. And don't think a man's skull isn't very tough. So, you know, how does she succeed? Does she succeed? Mm-hmm. She drives the tent peg right through his skull, his temples, into the ground on the first try. She only gets one. She goes softly to him. And he was fast asleep from weariness. He's been through a heck of a battle. And then Barak pursued Sisera, and Jael went out to meet him. And what does she say to Barak? You're looking for Sisera, right?
He's occupied.
I will show you where
he's
he is. She doesn't say, oh, well, you know, I'm this great hero and I've done the guy in already. No, she takes him into the tent and lets him see for himself. That's high drama, an understatement. I mean, this whole story is really a marvelous story in the way it just sort of flows. Come and I will show you the man you are seeking. And so he went into her tent, and there lay Sisera dead with a tent peg in his temple. Again, repetition for emphasis. And then it says, on that day God subdued Jabin, the king of Canaan, before the people of Israel, and the hand of the people of Israel bore harder and harder on Jabin, and so on until he destroyed Jabin, king of Canaan. And then we get into the song of Deborah, and that's probably what we have to do that next, because there's a lot in the song. Any questions so far? It's really a great story. Do you think so?
Yeah, cool.
So take another look at the song of Deborah. You don't think so? With that in mind, because the Song of Deborah elaborates some things. It's a high song, it's a great song, it's a heroic song. We'll talk about the Song of Deborah some more, and then we'll get into Jephthah's daughter, and Jill is going to talk to us, right? On great, the next time.
Valentine's Day.
Pardon me?
On Valentine's Day, I'm talking about.
Oh, yes, yeah. I haven't made that connection. So, I will show you some slides because we have some great slides, not so many, but they're really very fine. So, you know, we talk about women in the prophetic tradition, and it's there. You like the story of Deborah? Problem.
Can you turn the lights up, please?
I know why.
Hold on. Has to do with all these chords. Why don't we get a light?
That's good.
I'm not the best one for equipment, you know.
I should give up. Is there something wrong with this bowl?
Help, help. The bulb won't come on. Power.
Black and red.
Maybe we won't get any pictures today. Shoot. I think the bulb's burned out. Anybody got any ideas? No ideas?
The light's not
coming on.
The bulb is
Yeah. Okay, I'll have to bring them again next time and complain to them. See?
Did you try turning it off and on again?
Pardon me?
Did you try turning it off and on again? That's the only idea I had.
No bulb. Okay. No slides today. I don't know what to say. Any questions? Okay. Read the song of Deborah again and see what you make of it. See what voice it's in. See what celebrates. See what it celebrates. Thank you. Have a nice weekend. Yes, I had to buy for us. Who is the author? Oh, that's the compendium. Okay.
Yeah, it was really good.
Fine. All right. Good. You did well.
I was going to go to the grad library, but I couldn't.
It's no, you have to put some things together, but you might want to look at the video. The video talks about itself, and it's interesting in terms of the Old Testament attitudes and the New. I mean, it just talks about sexuality in general, but it comes out in that. So other than that, I don't know where to send you. Do you suppose it's the bulb?
It must be. I can't. There's no separate switch to turn the bulb on. If we look at the bulb, we might be able to tell.
Let me reverse it one more because I have to get my slide out. There. Okay, now, did you want to ask me?
I seem to have enlarged my syllabus, and I wonder if I could take another one.
I have four.
Okay, thank you. I'm enjoying the class very much.
Oh, I'm glad. I'm enjoying teaching it.
Perfect. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Did you lost your whole notebook?
Yeah, I can't seem to find it anywhere. I'm usually not quite that scatterbrained, but it'll pop up, I imagine. So how does the bulb put in here?
I don't know.